Good evening, everyone, and welcome back for the last installment of the Foundation of All Good Qualities. Let's start with a short meditation. And we're going to do a meditation related to this evening's topic. So finding a nice, comfortable posture. Letting go of any external distractions. Simply allow your awareness to descend into your body. Becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Bring your awareness to the area of your face, mouth and jaw soft and relaxed, and all the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. In this way, allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Allow the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. Simply allow the breath to flow naturally, effortlessly. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. give yourself permission to let go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns about the past or the future for the duration of this short meditation. Simply letting go of all of these things and allow the mind to come to rest in the stillness of the present moment. And simply focus on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Wherever you most distinctly notice sensations associated with the breath. Maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Now, do you have a sense that there is a me here who is meditating? A me who is trying to focus on the breath? A me that doesn't seem to depend upon anything else to exist? Do you have this experience? Can this me who is here meditating be found anywhere? Can me, the meditator, be found anywhere within the body? So search thoroughly every part of the body. See if you can find the me who is meditating. Is the meditator somewhere inside the head? Somewhere behind the eyes? Is the brain the me who is meditating? Or is the brain simply something which the meditator possesses? Something which I am using. Is the whole body itself the me who is meditating? Or is the whole body itself simply something which I possess? Something which me, the meditator, is trying to train? Is me, the meditator, anywhere to be found within the mind? So again, search thoroughly every part of the mind. See if you can find the me who is meditating. are any of the thoughts, emotions, or concepts in the mind? Are any of these the me who is meditating? Or our thoughts, emotions, and concepts, simply things which I have, things which me, the meditator, possesses. Is the mind itself the me who is meditating? Or is the mind itself simply something which I possess, something which me, the meditator, is using to focus on the breath? Is the body and the mind together the me who is meditating? Or is the body and the mind together simply two things which I possess? Two things which me, the meditator, is trying to train. Yet other than the body and the mind, what else is there here? If there's nothing more than the body and the mind here, then where is the me who possesses this body and mind, and is trying to train this body and mind? Where is me, the meditator? However, it's undeniable that there's someone here who's experiencing all of this. So there is a me here meditating. But how can this me exist if we don't seem to be able to find it? The me exists as something merely labeled on the basis of the body that is sitting here and the mind that is focusing on the breath. The merely labeled me is sitting here meditating. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. Simply resting in awareness itself. Resting within luminously clear awareness. Completely still. Completely open and spacious. Let's begin again by reading the foundation of all good qualities together, so we can start to get at least familiar with the words. Foundation of all good qualities. The foundation of all good qualities is the kind and perfect pure Guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely upon him with great respect. Understanding that the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once is greatly meaningful and difficult to find again. Please bless me to generate the mind that unceasingly, day and night, takes its essence. This life is as impermanent as a water bubble. Remember how quickly it decays and death comes. After death, just like a shadow follows the body, the results of black and white karma follow. Finding firm and definite conviction in this, Please bless me always to be careful to abandon even the slightest of negativities and accomplish all virtuous deeds. Seeking samsaric pleasures is the door to all suffering. They are uncertain and cannot be relied upon. Recognizing these shortcomings, please bless me to generate the strong wish for the bliss of liberation. Led by this pure thought, mindfulness, alertness and great caution arise. The root of the teachings is keeping the pratimoksha vows. Please bless me to accomplish this essential practice. Just as I have fallen into the sea of samsara, so have all mother migratory beings. Bless me to see this, train in supreme bodhicitta, and bear the responsibility of freeing migratory beings. Even if I develop only bodhicitta, without practicing the three types of morality, I will not achieve enlightenment. With my clear recognition of this, please bless me to practice the bodhisattva vows with great energy. Once I have pacified distractions to wrong objects and correctly analyzing the meaning of reality, please bless me to generate quickly within my mind stream the unified path of calm abiding and special insight. Having become a pure vessel by training in the general path, please bless me to enter the holy gateway of the fortunate ones, the supreme Vajra vehicle. At that time, the basis of accomplishing the two attainments is keeping pure vows and samaya. As I have become firmly convinced of this, please bless me to protect these vows and pledges like my life. Then, having realized the importance of the two stages, the essence of the Vajrayana, by practicing with great energy, never giving up the four sessions, please bless me to realize the teachings of the Holy Guru. Like that, may the Gurus who show the noble path and the spiritual friends who practice it have long lives. Please bless me to pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. In all my lives, never separated from perfect Gurus, may I enjoy the magnificent Dharma. By completing the qualities of the stages and paths, may I quickly attain the state of Vajradhara. So maybe just a short review of what we covered on the weekend before we continue on in the text here. So again, the text is called The Foundation of All Good Qualities. It's a short Lam Rim prayer written by Lama Tsongkhapa, who again is the founder of the Geluk school of Tibetan Buddhism. And he expanded upon these Lam Rim teachings, the stages of the path teachings that were brought into Tibet by Lama Ratisha around the 11th century. And as a result of that, the Geluk school was formed. And so in the Geluk school, the framework of practice is Lam Rim, the stages of path to enlightenment. Lama Tsongkhapa wrote many Lam Rim texts, and this is a very brief one that really just gives a sort of a short overview of the whole Lam Rim structure. So what we see in the first verse is we're talking about relying on a teacher, a qualified teacher, or here called guru. And we can understand from that verse that there are a lot of advantages to having a qualified teacher in the spiritual path, that they can really not only clearly present the path to us, but they can personalize it to our own specific needs, give us personal instructions, guide us individually, help correct any mistakes in our practice, and also tailor the practice, and help us to overcome obstacles in our practice. So there's very much a lot of advantages from having a teacher. Also, they would also give us a lot of inspiration in the spiritual path as well. The second verse was talking about the precious human life, really exhorting us to really reflect on the precious human life we have now, the fact that we've got this human life with lots of opportunities, good conditions, and that to not waste this life, to really make our life meaningful, to really understand we have this precious opportunity. It's difficult to get this opportunity and it's easily lost. But then, of course, the question is how to take advantage of this opportunity we have now. And so here in this Lamrim text, then the answer is divided up into three levels in terms of an individual person's capacity. So at the foundation level, at someone what's called small capacity, the minimum way we could make our life meaningful would be to strive for a good future. And so that is what is described in the next two verses here, where it talks about death and impermanence, and then the topic of karma, the topic of the law of cause and effect in terms of our actions and our experiences. And so by reflecting on these two topics, we would then really aspire to a good future through adopting an ethical lifestyle, through really understanding if we don't want to suffer in the future, then we should give up harmful, non-virtuous actions now. And if we want to have a good future, we should engage in virtuous activities. So this is the minimum way we could really make our life meaningful. But then, of course, we can understand that even if we do end up in a good future, we're still subject to suffering. And so then we can make our life meaningful at the next higher level. And that is not just striving for a good future, but to strive to break free of this entire cycle of existence called samsara, to strive for the goal of liberation from suffering altogether. And so that is someone of middling scope or middling capacity, and that is described in the next two verses here, the ones where it starts with seeking samsaric pleasures. That is to help us to understand that to develop the wish for liberation, this idea of renunciation, by understanding that there is no genuine happiness to be found out there, and that the source of happiness and suffering is within ourselves, and thereby to develop this aspiration to strive for that goal of liberation. And then how to do that were through these three core areas of practice of ethics, concentration, wisdom. Here the next verse, talking about the pratimoksha vows, was discussing the ethics part of the practice. The other two were not directly explained here because they are explained more in detail in the next level of practice, which is someone of great scope or great capacity, where not only are we striving for our own liberation from suffering, strive for the goal of nirvana, but understanding that everyone else is also stuck in this situation, and thereby to develop the aspiration for full awakening, for enlightenment, so that we can help liberate everyone else from suffering. So that was the next verse about bodhicitta, about developing this aspiration of bodhicitta, which of course is the entry point into the Mahayana path to enlightenment. Then how to achieve that enlightenment were, again, the six perfections, again, which can be condensed into those three core areas of practice: ethics, concentration, wisdom. And so the next verse here, talking about these three types of morality and the bodhisattva vows, of course, this is the ethical framework for the Mahayana path. It's the basis. Then the next verse, of course, is where we left off on Sunday, yesterday, where we talked about the two core practices of concentration and wisdom. So that last verse on the bottom of the page is where we left off. So we'll continue on there. And that again says, once I have pacified distractions to wrong objects and correctly analyzing the meaning of reality, please bless me to generate quickly within my mind stream the unified path of calm abiding and special insight. So calm abiding here, of course, is the translation of the Sanskrit word shamatha, and special insight is the translation of the Sanskrit word vipassana. So these are the two practices of concentration and wisdom, shamatha and vipassana. And we left off by yesterday talking about the shamatha practice, that is to develop this single-pointed concentration. And so now we're going to look at the Vipassana practice here, where it talks about correctly analyzing the meaning of reality. So we saw also on Sunday that the root of our suffering, of our mental afflictions and suffering, was this fundamental mind of ignorance. This mind grasping onto an independent me and an independent objective world. We saw that in that suffering and its causes chart yesterday. So when we look out on the world, of course, there really does appear to be an independent objective world there, and there really does appear to be an independent objective subjective me here. But it says here, by correctly analyzing the meaning of reality, means by investigating these appearances, we'll actually come to realize that things do not exist as they appear, that things do not exist independently. And so then what we will find is that through this investigation, we'll come to realize that things are not independently existent. And independent existence is sometimes different terms are used to describe that in the text. The most common term to talk about independent existence in the text is inherent existence. So there are a couple of terms there. Maybe I can mention those first. So things really appear to exist independently. There really does appear to be an independent subjective me and an independent objective world there. And in the texts, they use a couple of different terms to describe this. The most common one you'll probably see is inherent existence. Inherent existence has the idea that things are self-existent, existing within themselves, that the world is made up of many separate, discrete things, each one having its own inherent nature. There's another term called existing from its own side. And that has the idea that things are simply existing from their own side, meaning they're not depending or needing an observer for them to exist. That, you know, we walk in this room and there's already these flowers here existing completely from their own side, and that we are in no way contributing to their existence. So that's what existing from its own side means. The other term that's often used is true existence. Generally, in English, something's true if it doesn't deceive us. Now, all things appear to exist independent of us. If they really were to exist in that way, they would be true, which means if the way in which they appear and the way in which they exist match, then they're true. They have true existence. So true existence means existing in the same way in which it appears. Those three terms are all talking about the same thing, independent existence. They're talking about the same thing from different perspectives. But when we investigate these appearances, we'll come to realize that things are not independently existent. And a way of saying that is that things are empty of inherent existence. So empty of inherent existence means simply not inherently existent, not independently existent. This term here is emptiness. or in Sanskrit, shunyata. So emptiness does not mean nothing really exists. Emptiness simply means that things are empty of inherent existence. They lack inherent existence. They're not independently existent. So emptiness is not nihilism. Emptiness does not mean things don't exist. It means they're not independently existent. Why? Because they're dependently existent. And the word for that is dependent arisings. Arising here means coming into existence. So things come into existence dependently. Now, if we can understand how things exist dependently, that will be very helpful in understanding what emptiness really means. Because emptiness is the flip side of dependency. So let's have a look now at what does it mean for things to come into existence dependently? How are things existing dependently? The first way in which things exist dependently is that things exist depending on causes and conditions. For example, this clock here exists depending on causes and conditions. One of the first conditions necessary to have this clock is that someone needed to think about designing this clock. And then, of course, all the raw materials needed to be gathered. They needed to be refined. All the various components needed to be manufactured. And all those various components needed to be assembled. Plus all the people and factories and things involved were also necessary. All of those things were necessary for us to have this clock here today. So that means this clock exists depending on those causes and conditions. Fairly straightforward. But things also exist depending on their parts. Again, this clock exists depending on its parts. The plastic case, the screen, the electronic components, all the buttons, the battery inside. Without all of these parts, there would be no clock. So again, I think that's fairly straightforward. But what we're saying here, remember, is that because things are dependent, means that they're empty of inherent existence. But I think most of us are quite happy to accept that this clock exists depending on causes and conditions and its parts, yet at the same time accept that when you walk in the door, there's already a clock existing on that table. True? That shouldn't be possible. Because this idea should be overturning our belief that there's a clock sitting on the table here when we walk in the door. Doesn't seem to have that effect, does it? Why? The reason is that we don't really appreciate these two things at the deepest level. We only have a very superficial understanding of these two things. To really appreciate them at the deepest level, we have to go to the third way in which things are dependent. And that is that things exist depending on imputation, labeling, or conception. These three words all mean the same thing. So if you understand one of those words, you understand all three. And when we look at that, we might think, I think I know what that means. That means there's a single thing here which we're calling a clock. Again, that's quite superficial understanding. Because actually what's going on, of course, when we look out on the world, is that we're just receiving a mass of sense data, particularly visual data. And to be able to function, we have to make sense out of all of this data. And so what we do is we group various collections of data and make them into an object. So we sort of draw lines around certain collections of data and create an object to make sense out of all of this stuff. Otherwise we couldn't function. But we do more than that. And that is because we live in a world with others, we have to communicate. So in order to communicate with others, we have to give names to these things which we've created so we can communicate. So this is what labeling, conception, imputation means. It's the whole process of drawing a line around some collection of data, creating an object, and then giving it a name as well. How we divide up this world, of course, is not fixed. It's completely arbitrary, depending on the meaning that we want to get out of what we see. For example, how many objects are there? How many things are there?
Depends.
Isn't it just a single star?
Could be.
Or is it two triangles?
Oh, it's several triangles.
Or is it six triangles?
Could be.
Or is it six triangles and a hexagon? Or is it 18 single lines? How many objects are there? We decide. So the world is not divided up already into separate discrete things. We divide up the world according to the meaning we want to get. And how we divide changes depending on the context. In a certain context, we'll say there's a star there because that's meaningful. In another context, we'll say there's two triangles there because that's meaningful. In another context, we'll say there's 18 lines there because that's meaningful to us on that occasion. So there is no star there from its own side. So this is what we mean by things being merely labeled and not findable. So often here you'll hear the term, things are not findable. Not findable doesn't mean there's not a star. Not findable means amongst this basis, can you find something there which is a star from its own side? No, because the star only comes into existence through our conceptual framework. There is no star there from its own side. This is what emptiness and dependent arising means. To then help us better understand that, we can go back to those two ideas of cause and conditions and parts. So this is a timeline, this is a seed, and this is a plant that it produces. So we said that the plant exists depending on causes and conditions. So the cause is the seed, the conditions are the soil, sunlight, water, and so forth. So with that cause and conditions, the seed becomes the plant. We believe in independent existence. We believe seeds and plants exist from their own side, independent of our conceptual framework. If that's the case, then at what point does the seed become a plant? And that should be a fixed, obvious point, independent of our conceptual framework. So when does the seed become the plant in this timeline? Where's the point? Who can tell me? At what point does the seed become the plant?
Right.
We decide. We decide, exactly. The seed becomes a plant when this configuration of data stops looking like our concept of seed and starts looking like our concept of plant. And our concepts of seed and plants are a little bit different. For some of us, this is already a plant. For some of us, it's here. Some of us, it may be down here. We decide when the plant comes into existence, not from its own side. So the plant only exists within our conceptual framework. It's merely labeled, not findable in the basis. But it exists, of course. Another point here that can be helpful. We say that the seed and the plant are in a cause and effect relationship. And of course, by definition, if two things are in a cause-effect relationship, they cannot exist at the same time. So the question is, does the seed cease to exist before the plant comes into existence? So don't rush the answer, just have to think about it. Does the seed cease or stop existing before the plant comes into existence? So there can only be two answers, yes or no. Which is it? Does the seed stop existing before the plant comes into existence? What's the answer?
No.
No, which means that the seed is existing at the same time as the plant, which by definition is illogical. If two things are in a cause-effect relationship, the cause cannot exist at the time of the effect by definition. So no is illogical, not possible. But then if you say yes, then the seed has ceased to exist. Where does the plant come from if the seed's no longer there? So yes is also illogical. So both no and yes are illogical, which means a seed from its own side cannot produce a plant from its own side. It's illogical. So this is very good reasoning to overturn our common wrong sense of how things exist. And this is the sort of arguments that Nagarjuna uses, you know, we mentioned in the four schools, the Majjhimika philosophical system began with Nagarjuna in the second century with his classic text, this Mula Majjhimika Karika, Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way. In that text, Nagarjuna has 27 chapters of these sorts of arguments. He says, you believe in independent existence? What about this? And then you go, oh, yeah, that doesn't make sense, does it? And so this is really very powerful argumentation. Of course, if we don't accept independent existence, things are merely labeled, then all we do is we change the label. Then we have no absurd consequence. But as soon as we do, because here, actually, we have an unbroken continuum of change. Soon as we break up that unbroken continuum into discrete objects, we've got a problem. Things don't work. Things can't work. But if we don't break up that stream of change into discrete objects, then there's no problem. We just have a continuous stream of change, and within that, we're just labeling it differently to make sense of it. Then there's no problem. So merely labeled production, a merely labeled seed can definitely produce a merely labeled plant. An independent seed cannot produce an independent plant. It's just illogical. Stunned. Does it sort of make any sense? Maybe. Maybe yes, maybe no. Something to think about at least. Another point here is we say that the plant or the result depends on the cause. But this view here that we're looking at of emptiness is also saying that the cause depends on the result. How is that possible? How does the seed depend on the plant?
Like the father and the son, without the son or without the daughter, the child, there is no father. One cannot be a father.
Correct. You cannot be called a seed if there's no idea of plant. You can't have the idea cause without the idea result. Whether or not it produces a result is irrelevant. But you can only call something a seed or a cause if you have the idea, plant, or result. Therefore, the cause depends on the result. They're interdependent. They're mutually dependent. Like, you can't have subject without object. You can't have up without down, in without out. In that way. Then, one more point, and we'll use the pen for this one. We say that the pen exists depending on its parts. But is there a pen to be found here from its own side? Is there a pen amongst this basis there? Is it findable amongst the basis? Is that a pen? Nope. Is this tube a pen? Is this springy thing here a pen? No. Is the plastic piece, just the plastic piece on the end, is that a pen? Is the metal tube a pen? No. Is the ink inside a pen? No. Is the round ball on the end a pen? No. Where's the pen? And people go, oh, that's easy. The pen is the collection of that stuff. There's the collection. Is that a pen? Maybe not. So you have to tell me now when the pen comes into existence, okay? Anyone? No? No takers yet. Nobody yet. Why? So when does a pen come into existence? It comes into existence when this configuration of data closely enough resembles our concept of pen. And our concepts have at least two parts to them, appearance and functionality. So when this collection of data appears closely enough to our concept of what pen is, and it appears to function according to our concept of pen, then there's a pen, not before. There's no pen existing there from its own side. But pen exists, and we can write with it. But there's no findable pen there. Because if the pen exists independent of us, then everyone who looked there would see pen. Meaning if a caveman came in the door, they would see pen. And they'd go, oh, I better write a letter. I think a caveman may see a sort of a weapon to stab some dinner with or something. And if a dog came in here, they may see chewing stick. And if a tiny little ant came in here, they may see a possibility of a home, to somewhere to live. So is this a pen, a weapon, a chewing stick, or a home? It's all and none of those. From its own side, it's nothing. From the side of the observer, it can be anything, if it's meaningful. So this is what it means for things to be merely labeled, merely imputed. They're not findable amongst the basis. Of course, they work, they function within our conceptual framework. So emptiness and dependent arising are like flip side of each other. So when we say things are emptiness, are empty of independent existence, then the flip side of that is that they are dependent arisings. They are exist within our conceptual framework. So, therefore, what we can understand with this pen, normally we say this is a pen. And implying that the pen is this collection of parts here. The pen is the collection of the parts. But this view is saying that the pen is merely labeled depending on this collection of parts. So these are two very different statements. One statement is the pen is the collection of parts versus the pen is merely labeled depending on this collection of parts. If we can understand these two things are not saying the same thing, we're beginning to understand something about emptiness and dependent arising. So here is our old friend cognitive fusion. We have the basis, we have the label. And what we do when we say this is a pen is we're fusing the label to the basis. When we say this is a pen. What we should be saying, the pen is merely labeled depending on this stuff, this collection. So we have a label and we have a basis. The label is applying to the basis, but the label is not the basis. Just like the person is not their behavior. Person is doing behavior, or doing an action, like the cognitive fusion from before. So this is what we really need to understand, that things are merely labeled. Any questions about that so far? Everyone's completely...
Isn't it, I mean, you were talking about the pen, but when it's a human being who has consciousness who can kind of label themselves, isn't it different? I mean...
What's different? Constant. Sure. And you are labeling consciousness as well. Sure. Of course, everything is merely labeled. More stuff. I mean, there's a basis for the pen, isn't there? I mean, if there's no basis for the pen, there's no pen. But of course, see, we can go down infinitely. I mean, we can say pen, you know, depends on the parts, you know, and then, or like we can do the person. The person exists, you know, normally we say the person is the body and the mind. But just like the pen is not the collection of the parts. The person is not the collection of the body and the mind. Person is merely labeled depending on the body and the mind. And then if we go down one level to the body, which is the basis, the body is also merely labeled depending on the arms, the legs, the chest and the head. The body is not the collection of these things. It's merely labeled. And then we go down to the leg. Leg is merely labeled on, we can keep going down, down, down forever. There's no bottom.
Yeah, maybe what I'm trying to say is that the pen can just sit in a room all by itself and nobody.
What's there?
I don't know.
What's there? I mean,
See,
when we use this argument, so I think this argument's a bit like, you know, the tree falling in the forest and no one's there, does it make a sound? But you can't answer that question because the whole assumption in that is that there is a me independent of that tree who wants to know that. That's the assumption. And there is no such me. Is there? Right. So when we're saying things are merely labeled, we're not talking about that we have to be labeling it all the time. We're talking about the level of existence, that this exists only within the conceptual framework and not from its own side, independently. We're not talking about the fact that we have to be labeling this in every microsecond for us to be able to hold it and write with it. Otherwise it somehow disappears. We're not saying that. We're just talking about its level of existence. So there's a difference there. But a lot of these sort of questions or these difficulties come when people ask this, but if I leave the room, it's still going to be there. Often you can't answer that question because people, built into that question is the assumption there is a independent me that's leaving the room. If there's an independent me leaving the room, then yes, there is an independent pen left behind existing still there. Of course. Has to be. But this view is saying there's no independent me that leaves the room. There's a dependent me that leaves the room. And then there's a dependent pen. Yeah, I mean, this is something that we have to, I mean, really to know it well, we have to meditate on it and experience it in meditation. Because here what we're saying is this emptiness is saying there's no subject-object duality. And we live in a dualistic world. So the experience of emptiness is beyond conception, beyond duality, beyond language. So we cannot know emptiness directly, precisely, through our intellectual conceptual mind. Impossible. What we can do is try and grapple with this and get some sort of intellectual framework of understanding and use that in meditation and then meditate and come to experience this in meditation. No, they're always grasping. They do. Very primitive, but I think a dog has a sense of itself as a separate entity. I think so, yeah. I think very primitive. It has very primitive sense of self. I mean, not like us, of course. Christian.
Yeah, is this concept of emptiness only Buddhist?
No.
Yeah, exactly. No.
I mean, within Buddhism, there's a very clear, precise presentation of it that's very evident. But I think any tradition that is grappling with nature of reality, even though they may not have a very clear presentation on it, I think the people who, and particularly, of course, a tradition that has a meditative, contemplative aspect to it, I think the people who do then go into that aspect eventually will come to the same realization.
Yeah, for example, scientific people understand.
Yeah, but again, you can't know emptiness intellectually perfectly. I mean, I think even people like artists and stuff can have a sense that, you know, that there's no objective reality, independent objective reality. But that's a little bit intellectually, and I think like quantum physicists would have a sort of understanding there's no objective independent reality, but there's a little bit different between understanding that a little bit intellectually and actually experiencing emptiness directly. There's sort of a little bit more to do. Because it's only through experiencing emptiness directly that we will, of course, start to overcome ignorance and our mental afflictions. So we can be the smartest philosopher in the world, and intellectually we can say all the right things about emptiness, and we can be miserable and have a miserable life and full of mental afflictions.
I was thinking about, for example, the concept of relativity.
Yeah, sure. Well, from its own side, it's neither.
Why? Why couldn't it be both?
Well, it is both. If we pick it up and write with it, then it's a pen for us. If we pick it up and stab something, it's a weapon for us.
I mean, why couldn't you just say all the possibilities? Like it's 10 things instead of saying it's nothing.
We can say anything about it, but again, those things are existing within our conceptual framework. They're not existing from its own side.
Yeah.
Well, that's what we have to investigate. I mean, this is what it says here, correctly analyzing the meaning of reality. I mean, I can say all sorts of things, but, I mean, the thing is, it's up to us to investigate what the Buddha said and not just say yes or no, I believe him or I don't believe him. I mean, that's not going to get us anywhere. Because they have completely opposite properties. It can't be that those two things simultaneously from its own side.
So then you
from its own side, yeah, of course. I mean, nothing exists from its own side. This is what we're saying here. Well, it's a particle for the person who sees the particle, it's a wave for the person who sees the wave. No problem. Just like this is a pen for the person who sees it as a pen, it's a weapon for the person who sees it as a weapon. No problem. No problem. If you are holding on to things existing from their own side, yes, then there's a problem. Then there's a problem. Like this problem here. Anything for existing from its own side, then we have lots of problems. Things don't make sense anymore.
I was just wondering that one of the aspects to independent arising is the impermanence. How would you incorporate it?
I mean, of course, causes and conditions is impermanence, really. And actually, you know, we looked earlier that one of the early insights we can work with is impermanence. And impermanence is, again, it's something that we all intellectually accept. But that doesn't really do much for us in our daily life. It doesn't help us much. If we could really come to taste impermanence in meditation, our life would dramatically improve. One is that our attachment and aversion would dramatically drop because there's nothing to grab or push away. So attachment and aversion would be like dramatic. Means we would enjoy pleasurable things without craving and grasping them. And we wouldn't have the aversion to the unpleasant things. We would also from that understand there's no happiness to be found out there, so it's going to help us to turn our mind inward to look for happiness within ourselves. And the realization of impermanence, in the text it says it's very close to realizing emptiness. Because, you know, if we look at this example here, I mean, normally we think of impermanence as, you know, that in every moment, there's something that changes. Yeah? But that's not true, is it? Because our coarse idea of impermanence is that there's a thing here, that in the next moment it becomes this thing, and in the next moment it becomes this thing, yeah? But there are no things, there's like a seamless change. There's a seamless change. I mean, so intellectually, this is what we think impermanence means. There's a sort of these discrete small units that are changing.
Yeah, or trying to understand. Yeah. That's a flow, but
exactly.
It's very difficult.
Exactly. That's why we have to meditate on it. Because if we realize it, we'll realize that impermanence is not this, but it's just flow. There is no discrete changes happening. There's just flow. That really is so close to understand realizing emptiness. So close. Because that means there's no discrete chunks, which is what emptiness is saying, what dependent arising is saying. So it says in the text that if you realize impermanence, you're that close to realizing emptiness. So that's another way of coming at emptiness. If we can really work at impermanence and we realize it, I think someone who's realized impermanence, they hear these teachings, they go, oh, that's obvious. That's obvious. Because they know from experience that there is no chunks in the universe. It's all just smooth flow. There is no discrete bits. Anyway, on that note, it's time for a tea break. So let's have a tea break.